Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
On Monday, just before midnight, Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis held a press conference.
Thank you for joining us. I'm here with the prosecutors and investigators who have worked diligently on the investigation of criminal attempts to interfere in the administration of Georgia's 2020 presidential election.
She announced what we've all heard by now, that Donald Trump and 18 co-conspirators had been charged with engaging in a sprawling criminal conspiracy to disenfranchise Georgia voters.
The indictment alleges that rather than abide by Georgia's legal process for election challenges, the defendants engaged in a criminal racketeering enterprise to overturn Georgia's presidential election result.
Willis has been practicing law for more than 20 years. She's been the Fulton County DA since 2021, but the former president has been attacking her for months, calling her a rabid partisan, a radical Democrat, even a racist.
I make decisions in this office based on the facts and the law. The law is completely nonpartisan. That's how decisions are made in every case. To date, this office has indicted, since I've been sitting as a district attorney, over 12,000 cases. This is the 11th RICO indictment. We followed the same process. We look at the facts, we look at the law, and we bring charges.
Trump has been indicted four times in less than 5 months. But law professor Rick Hassan says this one is different. And a big reason why is Fonnie Willis.
She can't be controlled by anyone else. She is independent of the governor. She is independent of the federal government. So even if Trump becomes president, she can't be fired by him.
We see that Trump has already attacked Willis repeatedly over his social network, Truth Social. Are you surprised to see him zero in on her like this?
What surprises me is that he took so long to attack her. I mean, first of all, Donald Trump has a pattern of attacking anyone who's going after him. But there's something special about his attacks against Black women. Trump has this history of going after, whether it's Kamala Harris or Letitia James, the New York Attorney General. He seems to have a special visceral attack that he likes to bring out against Black women.
Black women telling him what to do.
Black women over whom he has no control.
Within hours of the indictment, Trump doubled down. On Tuesday, he vowed to hold a press conference in which he'd deliver irrefutable proof his election fraud claims are real. But at the end of the day, Trump might not even need proof. He may just need to wind down the clock.
I think one of the biggest questions is one of timing. Time is the enemy. Bringing that case to trial and to fruition before the 2024 elections seems like quite a tall order to me. It doesn't take much to delay things when you have to coordinate 19 defendants, 41 charges, lots of evidence. And the facts in this case, although the case is being brought in Georgia, there are allegations of actions that took place in Arizona, in Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, in Washington, D.C. That also complicates things. If Trump runs for office and is elected to office, he probably can stop the criminal proceedings against him for the duration of his presidency. So the biggest enemy here is time.
Today on the show, Fonnie Willis versus Donald Trump. I'm Mary C. Curtis, in for Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next. Stick around.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier, and it could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, or even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Let's dig deeper into these charges. This is Trump's fourth indictment in 5 months, if people are keeping track, but it's the first one to rope in, as you say, 18 indicted co-conspirators and 30 unnamed unindicted co-conspirators. You've talked about it a bit, but how did you react when you saw those numbers? And why is this the first Trump indictment to involve so many other people?
So I think, you know, one thing to say is that Jack Smith, the counsel in the federal case, made a strategic choice to bring a streamlined case against just Donald Trump. And he brought just three charges. And it doesn't get into every nook and cranny of everything that Trump tried to do. I think that Smith was making the calculation that this was the best way to assure that there could be a trial that could take place before the election, and that if Trump is found guilty, voters can take that into account. He's not telling the full story of what happened. This indictment in Georgia, in contrast, is the most comprehensive attempt to describe, with a focus on Georgia, but to describe nationally the plan to try to steal the 2020 election, which had a lot of different moving parts, from the fake electors to messing with voting machines to leaning on the Georgia Secretary of State. It's a very different kind of calculation. And maybe we can think of the two cases as complementary to each other.
Who are some of these other key defendants?
Well, there's Mark Meadows, who was Trump's chief of staff. Meadows has been absent from the federal cases so far. There's been talk that Meadows is perhaps cooperating with federal prosecutors. That didn't save him here. A number of Trump's lawyers are here, including Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, Sidney Powell, people who allegedly helped to try to use the rules for how we translate voters' votes into electoral college votes in Congress as a way of stealing the election. There are the fake electors and the people who facilitated the fake electors. So this is sprawling. It is national. I would say when you read the 90-plus page indictment, it's audacious. It is fearless.
Now, Trump has been charged with 13 counts, but the big one is the RICO violation. What exactly is RICO? If folks have heard about it, generally, it's in the context of a mob prosecution, right?
So RICO, it is essentially a claim of an organized criminal conspiracy. And so if a group of people get together and they engage in a common enterprise of crime, then they can all be charged together for participating in that. So, you know, you said the mob example. So, you know, you think about organized crime, there may be, you know, the hitman that goes out and does an assassination, and then there's another member of the group that engages in a drug deal, and another one that engages in extortion, and RICO allows you to see them as acting as a group in a common criminal enterprise, and to essentially hold all of them accountable for the actions of the others because they're working together as a team. Same kind of thing here. The claim is that the attempt to steal the election was being done in a team. Some people were dealing with messing with voting machines. Some people were doing the fake electors plan. Some were pressuring state officials to change vote totals. But it was a part of a common criminal enterprise to attempt to subvert the 2020 election outcome.
Could we see a situation where some people are convicted of some charges, but others aren't? With a prosecution this sweeping, how exactly will it work?
Well, sure. Yes. You know, and it's very common when you have a case, especially one involving a conspiracy among multiple defendants. Think about one of the defenses we expect Donald Trump to go forward with in his cases, which is to say, I was just relying on the advice of counsel. You know, my lawyers told me it was okay to do this. So that's what I decided to do. Well, I don't know if that's going to be successful or not. But if that kind of defense were successful, you can imagine the lawyer being convicted and Trump not. So it's certainly possible. And that raises a really important point, which is that the interests of the defendants here are not necessarily aligned. Right? So already we've seen in the federal case, those six co-conspirators who have not yet been indicted, pointing the finger at each other. The interests of the defendants do not align. Now, maybe Trump's going to pay some of the legal bills for some of these defendants, but he's already spending millions of dollars on his defense. There's going to be a lot of pressure on some of these defendants to make a deal and perhaps even offer testimony against Trump or others.
Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis says she plans to try all 19 defendants at the same time. Logistically, what kind of a challenge will that be?
Well, I mean, just fitting those people into the courtroom is going to be difficult. All the lawyers, the pretrial motions and discovery, all of that's going to take time. The witnesses, this just seems quite a challenge. I think she also said she hoped to bring it to trial in 6 months. That seems very optimistic and ambitious. So we'll see what happens. But it would not surprise me if down the line, some of these cases get hived off and considered separately.
The Willis case may be sprawling, but Rick says the main characters are Black Georgia voters. Why that matters after the break.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Jerusalem Demsis. I'm a writer at The Atlantic. And my beat, in many ways, is to challenge the conventional wisdom. I've written about how the problem with local democracy might just be too much voting, about how some environmental laws actually squash green energy development, and about how maybe the big demographic question of the day isn't overpopulation, but underpopulation. My new show is called Good on Paper. It questions what we really know about popular narratives with a new guest every Tuesday. Find and follow Good on Paper from The Atlantic, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Katie Riley. On the slow newscast from Tortoise, Donald Trump became the first former U.S. president in history to face a criminal trial.
The defendant repeatedly made false statements on New York business records.
This is not a trial. This is not an act of criminality.
We cannot and will not normalize serious criminal conduct.
This is the story of his first week in court, told through the transcripts. Listen now to the Slow Newscast wherever you get your podcasts.
Willis is about to step straight into the spotlight even more than she already has been. And Willis also is Black. You've written that one of the central things differentiating the Georgia case and the federal case is the role of race, both in the sense of the specific key players in the indictment and in the broader sense of how Trump targeted Black voters. Let's start with the key players. Who caught your eye?
What really caught my eye in this complaint was the focus on Ruby Freeman. Ms. Freeman was an election worker in Fulton County. She and her daughter, Shamos, were election workers that were falsely accused by Trump.
Ruby Freeman, she's a vote scammer, a professional vote scammer and hustler.
His lawyer, Rudy Giuliani.
Of Ruby Freeman and Shay Freeman Moss and one other gentleman, quite obviously, surreptitiously passing around USB ports as if they're vials of heroin or cocaine.
And Trump and his allies were trying to claim that Freeman alone had been manipulating the votes. At one point, he said 18,000 votes for Biden. And these charges against Ruby Freeman and her daughter led to threats. They've led to harassment. There's now a civil suit that Freeman has brought against Rudy Giuliani and others for these claims. The state of Georgia has cleared her and her daughter of any wrongdoing. They didn't do anything wrong, but blaming Black people for engaging in voter fraud is something that Trump has done a lot. He claimed there was fraud in Milwaukee, in Philadelphia, in Atlanta. These are all places with large Black populations, and the messages were either subtle or they were blatant, but they were that Black people are stealing the election from you.
Also, it really helps tell story because I recall that quite distraught and moving testimony with Ruby Freeman saying, you can't imagine what it's like to have the president of the United States attack a citizen that he should be taking care of.
I've lost my name and I've lost my reputation. I've lost my sense of security.
That was pretty emotional. So that really leads also into what you were saying about Willis wanting to tell a story.
That's right. Willis is personalizing this so that this is not just some kind of conspiracy against the system. It is a conspiracy to disenfranchise the Black voters who were part of the coalition that elected Joe Biden as president in Georgia and in other states.
What about the Georgia complaint itself? You wrote that it vindicates the interests of all Black voters in Georgia and around the country. Talk a little bit about how that's so.
Well, you may remember that the race was so close in Georgia, and it was the turnout of Black voters that put Biden over the top in Georgia. You may remember that right after the 2020 election, as these post-election fights were going on between the Biden campaign and the Trump campaign, there was a runoff in Georgia, and control of the Senate was on the line. And Black voters again turned out to give a victory to both Senators Warnock and Ossoff, giving Democrats the control of the Senate. So Black voters have been pivotal in the state of Georgia. And of course, they were part of the coalition that put Biden over the top in Pennsylvania and in Wisconsin. In many states, without the strong support of Black voters, Biden wouldn't have been president. And so it's not surprising, especially given Donald Trump's history, that he would attack those places with large populations of Black voters and claim that this is where the fraud is. And so this really is the crux of the kind of justice that Willis is trying to bring in Fulton County, Georgia.
In Georgia, there's been a recent spate of laws targeting voters. For instance, the 2022 legislation that bans giving waters to voters waiting in line. Given the broader push to clamp down on voters in recent years, how important is this case? Does it play into it at all?
Well, I think that you can understand the actions that were taken in the Georgia legislature and other legislatures as an attempt to react to what Trump has done to the Republican Party. Trump has convinced the base of the Republican Party that election fraud and irregularities are rampant. And so in response, legislatures have felt they've had to do something. Now, I don't think that all of the laws that Georgia passed or that other states passed are necessarily suppressing the vote. I don't think that these laws necessarily are all bad, as some of them may have actually improved things. But some of them seem clearly motivated by a desire to please Trump and the Republican base. So, for example, making it harder for people to vote by mail without evidence that vote by mail was used to engage in fraud in the 2020 election seems to be about trying to assuage the feelings of Donald Trump and the Republican base. I expect we're going to continue to see more of this, especially as demographics change in states like Georgia that are now purple states, in states like Texas that maybe in a decade will become more purple. I think we're going to see legislatures passing laws that may or may not have this effect, but that seem intended to make it harder for people likely to vote for Democrats to be able to register and to vote.
Rather than backing off, we see Trump doubling down. He announced on Truth Social that he's planning a press conference for this Monday, promising a, quote, large, complex, detailed, but irrefutable report that's going to double down on his false claims of election fraud in 2020. He's saying the findings from this report will somehow make Willis's charges go away. Without asking you to get inside Trump's head, what could he possibly be trying to do here?
Well, I mean, politically, he's trying to show his supporters that there's evidence on his side. They've produced nothing in the 2.5 years since the 2020 election. There's been no proof of substantial fraud or irregularities that could have changed the outcome of the election. So I don't know what he's going to come up with, but he's trying to muddy the waters. He's trying to claim that he has evidence that's going to support his side. I'm sure that whatever it is that he comes up with, it's going to be closely scrutinized. And if the past is any indication of what's coming, there's not going to be any substance to what he produces.
Willis says she wants to go to trial within 6 months. Regardless of whether she wins, could the fact that she's even brought this case at all affect future efforts to disenfranchise voters?
Well, one of the things that I've been saying is that if we don't have these trials, what is going to be the thing that is going to deter Trump and others like Trump from trying to do this again in the future? So I think the fact that these cases are being brought serves an important deterrent function in telling people that at the very least, if you try to do this, you're going to face a serious criminal charge. You know, whether it results in actual convictions and potential jail time is something we're just going to have to wait to see.
Given how divided America is in so many ways, do you think the American people will see it that way, or that their response will be just as divided?
I think the response will be divided. I think that Trump has managed to insulate himself from charges that he's engaged in wrongdoing. It's really hard to imagine any other politician of either party being able to be subject to multiple indictments for different activities across the country and not be just completely washed out as a politician and as a public figure. Trump has been, I think, brilliant in insulating himself from the truth and convincing his supporters that these alternative facts, as they were called, are actually the truth. And so there's no question that whether Trump is convicted or acquitted, or these cases never get to trial, there's going to be serious division in this country over the propriety of bringing charges against him.
Thank you, Rick Hassin, for coming on What Next?
It's been great to speak with you.
Rick Hassin is a professor of law at UCLA and the director of the Safeguarding Democracy Project. And that's the show. If you're a fan of What Next, the best way to support our work is to join Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. What Next is produced by Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, Paige Osborne, and Madeline Ducharme. We're led by Alicia Montgomery, with a little help from Susan Matthews. Ben Richman is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call and host of its Equal Time podcast. Find me on Twitter. I'm at mcurtisnc3. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.